Now the U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol held what could be its final public hearing earlier this afternoon. The hearing ended with the committee's most aggressive step yet, voting to subpoena former President Donald Trump. They also reviewed what the investigation has turned up so far and shared new evidence that suggested Trump knew he had lost the 2020 election, including a clip of former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson recalling a conversation she heard between Trump and former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows.
So he had said something to the effect of, "I don't want people to know we lost, Mark. This is embarrassing. Figure it out. We need to figure it out. I don't want people to know that we lost."
There are still unanswered questions like whether any high-profile political officials will face legal charges for their actions related to January 6th, including former President Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to what you heard today? Do you want to see the committee make criminal recommendations? Do you think former President Trump should testify? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, I want to start at the end now with that unanimous vote to subpoena the former president. Here's Republican Representative Liz Cheney, vice chair of the Select Committee, talking just before the vote.
"We are obligated to seek answers directly from the man who set this all in motion. And every American is entitled to those answers so we can act now to protect our republic."
This is the big takeaway in a lot of ways. What do you make of that subpoena?
It's a pretty bold move, but first off, to point out, remember, he's no longer president of the United States, and he can't claim executive privilege and say that he doesn't want to show up to testify. Now, he could show up, claim the fifth, but I think what's really being set up at this point is a challenge. The committee is challenging the president to now say, show up and make your case to the American public, make your case to us. And I think they're doing this to give him an opportunity to make his case. And I think also they want to do this if, in fact, they make any recommendations for criminal prosecution. They're giving the president or the ex-president one last time to speak for himself.
As we've seen with other requests and in some cases subpoenas from this committee, there are ways to stall in courts, ways to challenge their authority to do that. This could be a long legal process if they pursue this.
There's no question about it. And I think it's unlikely that we would see the president testifying at least before the January. And I say that because the legal proceedings will get dragged out for a while. And then depending on what the composition of Congress looks like and the partisan control after the November elections, any subpoena may very well be moot, because if there's a shift from Democratic to Republican control of Congress, it's unlikely that this committee will exist, or that if it does, that it will pursue that subpoena anyhow.
Do you see any likelihood that we would see the former president talking to this committee between now and when that new Congress is sworn in?
I'm very skeptical about it, even though it does give the president an opportunity to be able to make his case to the American public. Remember, he'd have to do so under oath, and if he were to do so under oath and he's subject to, you know, issues of perjury, I think he could do just as effective of a job talking the way he does right now, especially to his supporters, without showing up. So I expect him, as he's done with everything else, to fight. I mean, in fact, today we just got news that the Supreme Court has turned down one of the ex-president's requests regarding the Mar-a-Lago. Trump will resist this subpoena also.
Looking at what we heard from the committee today, a lot of this had to do with timeline. When were plans put in place? What did the president know, and when did he know it? Days before the election, a memo and public statements about plans to claim victory on election night, even before the count was done. Examples of the former Attorney General, Bill Barr, saying, "Yeah, I told the president this Dominion thing was a fantasy theory." And then the president days later stating publicly what he had just been told wasn't true. How important was establishing that timeline, do you see, in today's hearing?
I think the timeline and establishing it was very important for a lot of reasons. One, what it speaks to, again, if I can sort of speak as a law professor who thinks about criminal law too, it speaks to criminal intent. It indicates that the president laid out plans to intend to do certain types of acts, that is to either tell the vice president, you know, to nullify the electoral vote, or to come up with fake electors, or for states to manufacture votes. It speaks to the president having laid this out for a while, and that becomes critical to making any type of criminal case. It also speaks to the fact, as we heard several times today, that the president knew, the president was advised by Barr and by others, he had lost the election, that there were no stolen votes, there was no widespread voter fraud, and he chose to disregard. So if I can use the word for today, or for now, intentional or willful, they were speaking to the state of mind of what Donald Trump knew, and for how long that he knew it, as the election was unfolding, and then after the election, as the recounts were going on.
Talking to David Schultz, law professor at the University of Minnesota, about today's January 6th committee hearing. Likely last public hearing of that committee, ending with a subpoena issued for former President Trump. You can join in with your reactions to what you saw or heard today, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Willem joins us now in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. Well, the most frightening thing I heard was the law professor's assertion, or someone, that when the Republicans, if they take over the Congress, that this would all go away. That historic event, no president has ever tried to do this. So anyway, the reason I was calling was because I think from my personal experience, I'm an immigrant to this country. I've always been told about American exceptionalism, how this is a country of laws and not men, and no man is above the law, and equal justice for everyone. That's what people always told me about America. And I moved here with my family in the late 1950s. Both my parents survived World War II in the Netherlands. My father was in a concentration camp for 3 years. He was in the Dutch resistance. His brother was executed by the Nazis. My mother was in prison for handing out anti-Nazi leaflets. So they instilled in me the importance of the truth and how bad things happen. When, you know, Abraham Lincoln, in a quote, said, "Tell the people the truth and the nation will be safe."
Willem, thanks for the call. David, Willem, I think trying to lay out what's at stake here, do you think that something as fundamental as Willem is talking about, the concept of, nobody being above the law, is at stake here?
I think that's part of what's at stake, but I think also what's at stake is the reputation of the United States as a democracy across the world. You know, I teach abroad quite a bit, and I was over in Lithuania recently, and the world is watching us, you know, that we want to claim to be the world's greatest democracy, the leader in democracy. And to see what happened on January 6th, I think not just shocked Americans, but the rest of the world. And they're looking to see what we're going to do next. You know, other countries in the world hold their elected leaders, including their presidents or prime ministers, responsible when they violate the law. And so in many ways, this hearing is a referendum on American democracy, and not just in terms of how we operate internally, but in terms of the message that we are sending to the rest of the world. And I mention this because this caller is talking about thinking about America as the perspective of an immigrant turned American citizen. And so he captures really well kind of these dual images of how the world and how Americans themselves are viewing these hearings.
Thanks for the call, Willem, at 800-642-1234. A lot of focus, David, today on former President Trump's speech at the Ellipse, where he ultimately called on people listening to march to the Capitol. Premeditated, apparently, according to emails from the organizers, there were plans for him to spontaneously call for this. That said, is that illegal? Is this free speech? The president can say what he wants?
Well, this is interesting because we've heard for over a year now people saying the president was just exercising his free speech rights and what he was doing there. I think what the hearing did today was really quite interesting in terms of establishing the fact that the president, again, knew that the claims of voter fraud were false. He appeared to know that the demonstrators were dangerous, knew what their plans were in terms of marching to the Capitol. And the reason why I mention this, there's a famous U.S. Supreme Court case called Brandenburg versus Ohio, and it draws the line between free speech and when something is not speech. And what the court said is when you say something that advocates imminent lawlessness, That's imminent. That's no longer protected speech. If everything that we heard today was correct, what the president said and what he did on January 6th crossed the line from constitutionally protected speech to some form of what? Inciting of a riot. And if that's accurate, the president is now potentially liable for whatever the federal laws that would be in place for not just interfering with a federal proceeding, but also in terms of what? Perhaps, again, if I could use that phrase, inciting a riot or inciting destruction. He bears responsibility, if the committee's correct, for the rioters and what they did.
We're talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, with us today to look back at what we learned in today's January 6th hearing. Could be the last televised hearing from the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you learn from the January 6th hearings today and in the past? What questions are still unanswered as far as you know? What is your reaction? What do you want to see come out of all this? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about today's hearing for the House Committee investigating January 6th. David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota stays with us, and you can join in too at 800-642-1234. Have you followed the hearings? What has been the most surprising to you? What do you wish you know that we still don't know? What do you hope comes out of all of this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls with Mike in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hi. I was wondering if the professor knows of any state laws that have been created in the wake of the former president taking advantage of norms or precedents of the past and loopholes or gray areas, such as requiring the filing of tax documents for any federal offices that they may want to run for in order to be placed on ballots or any similar type of tightening of regulations.
Mike, thanks for the call. I remember hearing some states were looking at that particular idea. David, have we seen that or other state laws, Mike is wondering, in the aftermath of January 6th that you see as significant?
Well, the Brennan Center in New York has documented in general across what, 42 or 43 states, nearly 500 laws aimed at trying to change election rules, for example. There's been some states that are trying to both, let's say, tighten the law and some you might say loosen the law in terms of, let's say, voting requirements. But in general, I think where the caller is going is in terms of maybe, I think what I'm hearing here, actions about January 6th. In terms of criminal laws, I think all the states have pretty clear language there regarding things such as inciting of a riot, things like that. But if we're talking about also adding qualifications for running for office, mm-hmm. states have leeway to do that for their own state offices, but the federal constitution pretty much limits the ability of states to be able to add things. For example, I know many people were concerned that the president, for example, Trump, never released his tax records. And they're saying, well, maybe there ought to be laws that require that. It's just not clear as a matter of constitutional law if states could now say, as a condition of appearing on the ballot in our state, a person would have to release, running for president, their tax returns. But I know states have talked with this, and so I'll say that it's a mixed bag in terms of what we've seen since January 6th. And not a surprise, there's a partisan divide out there in terms of how states and legislatures have reacted to January 6th.
Mike, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. One possible legal change at the federal level that may be in the works. I think, talked about this before, David. The process by which Congress and the vice president certify the electoral vote. President Trump thought to then Vice President Pence could block particular slates of electors. Everybody else seemed to disagree, including Vice President Pence himself. Can you talk about the latest on the efforts to clarify and take out any confusion about how that works?
Sure. If we look at the U.S. Constitution itself, there is no role for Congress in terms of second guessing the states on their electoral votes. The only role that Congress has is if a candidate for president does not get the majority of electoral votes, then the House gets to pick the president. But until then, no role. After a couple of disputed elections after the Civil War, what was called the Electoral Vote Count Act was adopted as a way for Congress to try to resolve disputes in let's say, questions about which electoral votes to seat from a particular state. But at no point did that act say that the vice president or Congress had the authority to just nullify electoral votes. The legislation before Congress right now, which is getting bipartisan support, and I should point out that Mitch McConnell supports it as well as Democrats support it and many Republicans, would clarify and say that Congress has, at best, I'm going to say a ceremonial role, or maybe a master's of ceremonial role. The vice president, who when he presides or she presides over the counting of the electoral votes, it's merely ceremonial. There is no substantive power to say, I accept or reject. I want to say it's the equivalent of what? It's somebody at a contest opening up something and saying, and the winner is. Like I'm trying to think about the Academy Awards. And the Electoral Vote Count Act reauthorization will make that very, very clear.
Let's go back to our callers. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I was listening to the hearing earlier today, and I think it might be an odd quirk of history that the reason Ron Johnson didn't object to Wisconsin electoral votes is because Nancy Pelosi was trying to negotiate with Mitch McConnell to speed up the hearing and basically get the Republicans who are going to object to not have as many objections. So basically, I think one of the things I heard her say is could they limit it to one state if they were going to object to a state's electoral votes being counted, which would be an odd quirk of history. They very definitely, according to the testimony we heard, had guns in that crowd. So that's something else that was interesting compared to what Mr. Johnson said. Also, the deep state that Trump loved to complain about, kind of wondered if the deep state, the real one, was if Trump was trying to build one within the government for this event.
Nate, thanks for the call. That first point, it was footage we hadn't seen before of Speaker Pelosi and others trying to quarterback a response and get this vote to happen that night. And he's referring to that negotiation. It's like, can you just object to Arizona and then let this thing get done?
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, at some point, I think Congress everybody in Congress was shell-shocked at what happened that day, and they wanted to get their work done. Pelosi did, McConnell did, the vice president did. And so there was a lot of negotiations on January 6th. How do we actually move this forward so it wouldn't get dragged out? Because also, it's already January 6th. We're, what, within 14 days of the new president being sworn in. So, yes, there were things that they had to do that night, and they wanted to figure out ways so that it wouldn't get dragged out even further, because they also didn't know at that time, were there going to be more rioters? Were they still in danger or not?
Thanks for that call, Nate. Nate also wondering who else in the Trump administration is getting attention from this congressional committee and maybe in the future from the Justice Department, who might have gone along with this, who might have obstructed investigations into it. What kind of things are you watching for, David?
Well, we know that at one point Mark Meadows was subpoenaed, didn't show up. He's probably somebody who's going to be looked at, as well as we heard references to Trump's possible selections of a new attorney general. In the waning days, I'm looking to see people like that. We already know that Steve Bannon, who is no longer part of the administration, has been looked at. So I think we're going to be looking at some of his senior advisors who were there. And we shouldn't forget that in earlier hearings, this committee was also looking at other members of Congress who might have been in consultation with the President of the United States. And I'll be curious to see how all that unfolds.
And in just our last couple of minutes, the big question here is, of course, this is a congressional committee. They can't arrest people. They can't charge people with crimes. the Justice Department can. What are you watching for there to see if they will pursue the evidence the committee presented, the evidence they've gathered themselves, and might be charging higher ups involved in this?
I think that's exactly the issue. If I can tie it back to something from before also, if Trump refuses to show up also to Congress, Congress could issue a contempt of Congress and ask the Justice Department to also hold the ex-president in contempt of court, which could be criminal. And what we're looking at here is, even if that doesn't happen, at some point this report goes to the Justice Department, and Merrick Garland, who's the Attorney General and the Justice Department, has to make a decision. Do they believe there's enough evidence here to indict probably the ex-president or maybe any members of his circle? And that's what I'm going to be looking to see as this committee, if it holds any more hearings, but more importantly, in its final report, does it make the conclusion, does it render the conclusion that the president should be charged? That's what we're really looking for here, is to see. And this will stand potentially in contrast to what a few years ago, the Mueller report, which had looked at whether or not the president and his administration, the president and his campaign, was doing anything in terms of trying to illegally interfere with the conduct of the 2016 elections.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and of law at the University of Minnesota. He's with us today to talk about what we learned in today's hearing on the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol, what could be the last public hearing in this series, though the investigation is still going on, and a look at where the investigation goes next. If you still have questions that might be fodder for a future show, you could always email us with what you want to know that we don't know yet. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org.